Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
This is a very uncomfortable topic for most African Americans and whites. We don't know how to talk to each other about it. And essentially, we've been talking past each other, which is what people are exhausted about.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Mitchell Andrew comes from one of the South's most storied political families. His dad, Moon Landrieu, was mayor of New Orleans in the 70s. His sister, Mary, was a U.S. senator. Mitch was lieutenant governor of Louisiana, and then he served as mayor of New Orleans from 2010 to 2018. After leaving office, he founded the E Pluribus Unum Initiative to study issues involving race in the South. He spent the past year interviewing people all over the region as part of conversations in 28 communities involving issues such as segregation, equity, and violence. The report that came out of that work is called Divided by Design. I talked with Landrieu about the report and also about President Trump's recent comments comparing the impeachment process against him to a lynching. Here's my conversation with Mitchell Landrieu. What led you to form this organization?
Well, you know, besides just being a proud Southerner, I was born in New Orleans in 1960 into a really big family. I have eight brothers and sisters, and collectively we now have 38 nieces and nephews. I'm a father of five children, married, and a lawyer. But I served in the legislature for 16 years. Lieutenant governor of the state of Louisiana, was elected to two terms in this state, served there for 6 years. And then, of course, I came back home to New Orleans to help rebuild the city. And that experience, both in my personal life and my public life, caused me to really think about the role that race has played, or our inability to get past race, and how far behind the South is from where, in my opinion, she could be, and where the country could be, quite frankly, if we ever really understood our history and we stopped letting people divide us by race and class. And I've just always thought in my life when I've tried to solve problems that we have much more in common than apart. However, during that entire time that I was working, race always and class always became a place for division. And of course, we've seen throughout our history, throughout the world, that human beings can do awful things to each other when they start treating them less. And it's been part of our nation's ethos that, you know, all men are created equal. We've never really quite lived up to that.
So y'all went to 28 communities throughout the South, cities, smaller places, all rural and urban. Could you explain a little bit about what it was like when y'all got there? Like, what would you do when you got to a place?
Well, I will answer that question.
Sure.
But let me just tell you why we spent time very, very low-key talking to people. You know, when you think that there's a problem, everybody has anecdotal evidence about that. They have their own opinions about it. They have their own experiences about it. When you're the mayor of the city of New Orleans and the catastrophe is happening every day, you know, you don't really have time to think, and you draw conclusions about things. I wanted to take time, just really slow down. Instead of listening to what we hear coming over of CNN, MSNBC, or Fox, and listening to political people try to interpret for American citizens what they think, why don't we go talk to them ourselves? Why don't we listen to them? Why don't we hear them? Why don't we try to hear it through the lens that they intend to communicate it, so that we can then come up with clearly communicating to the country what everybody's really thinking? Because my supposition was there was going to be a lot of common ground, but also expected to find a lot of division. So what we did was we decided to start in the South, and that is where, obviously, where we're from. I think the South has a special obligation because of our history related to slavery, to address this issue and to really kind of find people where they are. So we weren't going to political rallies, or if we would have called on the mayor as a matter of respect because we were in their town, it wasn't designed to be a mayor's meeting of what you would typically call community leaders that normally happen in city councils. We wanted to actually go into communities and talk to individuals. We talk to white people and African-American people and rich people and poor people. We talk to Hispanic people and Vietnamese people, whoever was in the communities in the cities that we went to who were really just regular folk. That's one thing that we did. The second thing that we did to make sure that we weren't just hearing anecdotal evidence is we actually did focus groups. And so we had firms that are experts at this that called, again, regular folk, you know, into a room. And they would sit in the room six at a time, eight at a time, 10 at a time, depending on what the sample was. And sometimes they were folks that had college degrees or master's degrees. Sometimes they were folks that had high school degrees. Sometimes it was folks that didn't. And sometimes the groups were mixed. Sometimes they were just white. Sometimes they were men. Sometimes they were women. We just tried to get every different kind of mix so that we could make sure that we really heard everything that everybody wanted to say in all kinds of different settings. And then we would actually have invite the community to come to meetings, and then we would have community discussions. Those things. And each it changed in every community that we went to, depending on where we were and whether people were willing to talk to us or not. But we really feel like we heard what it is that people had on their minds and on their hearts. And we were in places where people felt comfortable to speak the truth as they thought it was. Now that we think we know what it is that they've said because they've clearly communicated that to us, let's see if we can take all of the data, all of the research that we've done, and draw some conclusions from that, which we did. And we drew 15 conclusions. And then after that, we said, well, if those are the conclusions, how do you go about creating an environment where these individuals can talk to each other, know each other, and see if they can begin to solve the problems that that those conclusions make really, really clear.
I wonder what the emotional tenor of those, all these conversations you had over time. Obviously, it's a bunch of different people, and it's going to be a wide range. But I know just from living in the South my whole life that when this stuff tends to come up, whether it's white folks or black folks or whatever, there's like a almost a baked-in sort of weariness about it. Like, yes, this is a terrible thing, or maybe some people feel like it's not a terrible thing or whatever. But there, it feels like it's a conversation we've had for a long, long time. I'm wondering what the sort of the emotional tenor of the conversations that y'all had was like.
Well, interesting. I would respond to that in two ways. First of all, all of the conversations were calm and respectful, every one of them. We never had a shouting match with anybody. We wanted to make sure that we listened and that we heard, and they knew that we heard what it is that they said. We didn't have debating classes, you know, in our debating forums at this point. And we learned a couple of different things. Number one, and this is universally true, that this is a very uncomfortable topic for most African Americans and whites. We don't know how to talk to each other about it. And essentially, we've been talking past each other, which is what people are exhausted about, talking past each other and not getting anywhere. It's clear that people are tired of that. And so what E. Pluribus Unum wants to do is try to find a pathway where we can actually go through this, not around it, not over it, not under it, but through it. Now, once you get past that truth, then the polling data and all of the interviews that we did evidenced a very, very, very wide divide. African Americans don't think we talk about it enough. White people think we talk about it too much. Hispanic people think half and half, depending on what communities that they're in, which itself is a very interesting finding. Because, yeah, some people are like, whatever. No, it wasn't a problem. Slavery was a long time ago. Now, if you ask people, and the poll reflects this, that white people particularly, hey, white person, do you think that the vestiges of slavery exist today? Most of them do not. They don't think that there's any consequence or sequela from slavery today. It was such a long time ago. Nobody knows anybody. African Americans clearly don't think about that. Now, if you ask people, well, do you think that slavery, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, civil rights, and the things that have happened have an impact today? More white people will say, yeah, I can see that and I can feel that, which is means that there's a movement. But listen, let me just mention this story. I was talking to my dad today, who, as you know, served as mayor of New Orleans before I did, from 1970 to 1978, 1960. He was one of only two white legislators had voted against segregation, and he lived through a lot of what's gone on now. He said to me today when I told him what I just told you about white people thinking that slavery so far ago, he said, son, let me tell you something. He said, I'm 89 years old. I was born in 1930. He said, I knew, spent time with, and hugged my great-grandmother. She was born in 1849. He goes, I physically touched this woman. She was 16 years old when Lincoln died, which meant that she lived during the time of slavery and lived through the Civil War. And he said, so it wasn't really that long ago, and it's not that far back when you begin to think about generational consequences from acts of slavery. Now, I personally don't think it's very arguable that institutions that we have, the way we build highways, the way we build neighborhoods, how we constructed our school districts, what gerrymandering looks like, or voting, you know, rights laws. I don't think there's much doubt that there is institutional bias that has made it much, much harder for African Americans in the South to do well. And that is really kind of what is defined as institutional racism. Many whites feel from our discussion that racism to them means them being angry or mean or hurling a epithet personally at another human being. And that's partly true, you know, and anytime you treat another human being as less than you for whatever reasons, if it's about race, is an act of racism. But it's much, much deeper than that. It's the, and African-Americans tend to think that although that's horrible and they don't want to be the victims of that today, that institutional bias and institutional racism and things that have stopped them from building generational wealth, like not being able to get mortgages and not being able to build homes in certain areas and consequently pass it down to their children, has made it harder for their kids than it has for other kids. And there's a lot of truth in a lot of these things. And the question gets to be for the South, you know, can we talk about it?
You talked about, you know, a minute ago, the sort of institutional racism and the divide over whether that's real or not and how people feel it and how it lands on people and all. And this report that you guys came up with is called Divided by Design. Is that the design you're talking about? Like when you say design, is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. I think one of the, you know, it's one of these things is about the language we use. So for example, if you start talking about white privilege, reparations, you know, everybody's eyes start to roll, people start to cough, they walk away, mostly white people. You know, but if you start talking about, you know, values, like, you know, do you think that if you broke something, you should fix it? Or do you think that if something was not designed properly and it hurt somebody that you should redesign it? They go, well, yeah, I can. Yeah, I mean, of course, that's true. But then you have to make the next step and say, well, listen, let me show you how things were designed. So, for example, I'll give you an intentional bad design. And this is just as late as the 60s. This isn't, a, you know, 1930 or 1910. But when they began to rebuild neighborhoods in the great urban revival that we had through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, especially when everybody who fought in the war was coming back, African-Americans and whites, not everybody got the GI Bill. GI Bill gave money to returning soldiers to go build houses in certain places. There would, when neighborhoods were being rebuilt, banks would draw red lines around certain neighborhoods, and they would not give mortgages to African-Americans. Now, anybody that's had a grew up in a house that you owned, you know that that house mostly, you know, gets more valuable. And the kind of equity, that financial equity, you know, that you talk to, that there is some kind of institutional wealth that is generated from that, that is actually passed down. If you're able to afford insurance, if you're able to get a good job, all of those things did not really exist for members of the African-American community, all of them. And because there was discrimination, that is an intentional design. And it stopped people from getting ahead. So, you know, if you lose 10, 20, 30 years of building wealth and you can't pass that down to your kids and the kids don't have the opportunity then to start there and then lift their generation, because, of course, everybody, 100% of people want their kids to do better than they did, 100%. And matter of fact, that's what everybody wants. They want a good job and they want to be able to give their kids more. If you weren't able to do that because you couldn't move in a certain neighborhood or because they stopped the streets from going through, or because they wouldn't let a bus line go into another neighborhood because they didn't want African-Americans coming into the neighborhood, or because they gerrymandered legislative districts to make sure that they packed African-Americans in the district so they couldn't have more votes than not. All of those things are things that were designed by intention. Human beings hate to change. I mean, whatever it is that we have, we are anathema to change just because we get used to it. And some people that are actually being hurt by things don't like changing their things. And as a matter of fact, change really freaks people out when it comes too fast. So you're bumping up against that as well. So if somebody comes into town, you know, and you've been living a certain way, you go, man, look, I'm tired, I'm old, you know, I don't really feel like, you know, doing it better, and I'm just going to leave it alone. As a matter of fact, I remember a conversation that I had with a gentleman. I was in the Delta. I won't call the town, but this particular gentleman was an older gentleman. He was African-American. And, you know, like in everybody knows that what I'm about to say is true, that if you go into a southern town and white folks live in a certain place and African-American folks live in another place, there's a railroad track, there's a river, or there's a lake that or a highway that separates you. You know, that's why we call, well, you know, back of town, front of town, you know, wrong side of the tracks. All of that stuff comes from that language. Now, if you're in the South, you know, you don't think about this because every day it's just something that you naturally do. And then you start ask yourself, well, why do all the white people live over here? And why do all the African-American people live over there? Well, it was designed that way. You know, are there were things in place that forced it to move into that direction? But this gentleman that I was talking to, I asked him, I said, you know, because the town was divided by a lake. And the whole conversation that he was in with other people was African-Americans live on the other side of the lake and the white people live on this side of the lake. I said, well, sir, do y'all have any racism here? He goes, oh, son. He goes, we good. He said, we have reached a place of peaceful segregation. And I had never heard that before. And I said, I don't understand what you just said to me. And he said, your ears don't work. I said, no, I heard you. I said, I just don't understand you. He goes, we cool. We over here, they over there. Now, that takes my ears back to 1890, you know, with separate but equal. But of course, it's never equal because, you know, folks that have more change in their pocket or do better than folks that don't have more change in their pocket. And so what he basically was saying is, look, this is as good as it's going to get for me. And I'm good to go. And I don't really feel like dealing with it. But that's not what young people think. When you look at this poll, people, young folks, I'm going to say under 30 because I'm an old man now, I'm 59. But under 30, I mean a lot of young folks and folks that have higher levels of education, I want to say a college degree or higher, they really want to change it.
Were there places on this tour that you felt like were having a tougher time, maybe the most, and were there a place or two that you felt like had sort of gotten a better handle on what to do?
Actually, yeah. There were, without calling the names out of the communities, what we did find that in Louisville, Kentucky, and in New Orleans, because when I was mayor, we really talked a lot about an equity agenda, making sure that everybody was treated fairly, gender, race, etc. And in Louisville, Kentucky, where Mayor Greg Fisher had a specific program, that people were much more open to talking about it and that they had made some progress. As I said, without calling out the names of the communities, there are some communities throughout the South that have gotten themselves into a position economically where everybody's doing a little bit better than, in other words, really, really, really difficult communities that are struggling financially. In communities where whites and African Americans are struggling financially, where the economy is leaving them behind, they all feel like they're getting left behind, but the racial tension's higher. When everybody's got a little bit more money in their pocket and more people are working and their wages are higher and they're feeling a little bit more comfortable, the racial tension is less, which I think is really interesting, you know, and demonstrates to us that some of this is economic. It's just not personal. It's just that sometimes people are ascribing to people of the other race the reason why they're not doing well.
When we come back, I talked to Mitchell Andrew about the recent comments from President Trump comparing the impeachment process against him to a lynching. Landrieu has many thoughts. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
If you'd like to be a part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can also reach me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me @TommyTomlinson. What really helps is if you subscribe to Southbound on the NPR One app. That lets NPR know you're listening and helps us get out the word to even more people. Thanks for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Mitch Landrieu. The divisions and the sort of anger or whatever that people have thought of as being kind of a Southern thing for a long, long time are now kind of writ large across the whole country. And I'm wondering if what your thoughts are on the idea that, you know, are we becoming more like the rest of the country, or is the rest of the country becoming more like us?
That's a great question. It's a loaded question too.
Well, that's intended to be, yeah.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Let me try to answer it with a couple of different layers. First of all, I love the South, and I am a really deeply proud American, have a great sense of faith, family, and country. And I have great hope and aspirations for America. I happen to think, though, even as a great patriot, that I have the right to call out our country when we're not living up to our ideals. And if, in fact, the Founding Fathers said, out of many, we are one, that all men are created equal, that we're endowed with certain inalienable rights of life, liberty, and property, that, you know, they kind of meant it. Even though we have to acknowledge that we've never actually really gotten there. That's part A. Part B, as a proud Southerner who went to school in the Northeast that constantly got beat on from being in the South, you know, and I have a chip on my shoulder about how the rest of the country sees the South. I happen to think we're great. I think it's the lifestyle's beautiful down here. I think the environment's beautiful. I think we have the kind of things that we have down here that you can't even come close to in the North. The Northeast, the Midwest, or the West, and I'm just proprietary about that, and I have a jersey on, but I do ache for my South because, as a result, primarily of slavery, we sent 4 million people out of the South. They left because when they were here, we enslaved them, and so when they were freed, they did what a very thoughtful, rational person would do. Said, I'm getting the hell out of there. When we lost 4 million people, what we lost was an incredible amount of intellectual talent, raw material, raw capital, where these individuals took their wares and they went to other parts of the country and spread the value that they had here. And we lost that. White people lost that. Not just African Americans lost an opportunity to live here. We lost what value it is that they bring. All you've got to do now is just go back through history and look at the incredible progress that African Americans have made in sports, in medicine, in politics, and say, you know, many of those individuals used to live here and their families did, and we lost that. And we sent some of our best players, you know, to the other part of the country. What would it look like if all of those people, now the same thing happened when they left and the economy went down, that white people, many of them poor, many of them not having a great education, they didn't do particularly well either. And so you have to think about that for a minute when the people from the North, you know, if we're putting our jerseys on in the geographically in the country, how much better we could be if we all really decided that we wanted to come together and work together. There are examples of when we have done that and examples of when we have done well. That's why I think the future of the South is really important. And I think that because we had a specific role that we played, we saw more people into slavery in New Orleans than any city in America, that we have an obligation to stand up and be counted on this before we point our finger at the rest of the country. Now, having said that, it is absolutely true that when you get outside of the South, racism is alive and well, and class differences are alive and well. And they, you know, I think it's always been there. It's been one of those things where we've worn that burden more loudly than the rest of the country, but it is clearly an issue. And today, even though we're talking about African American and white, you know, we've had lots of examples when other minorities have been hurt as well. The Japanese internment comes to mind immediately. Native Americans or American Indians comes to mind. This whole notion of some people being superior to others manifests itself across racial differences, not just in America, but in any other country as well. And when that has happened, bad things have occurred. And the country's never, ever really going to do well unless we bring everybody along with us. And they're welcome and they have an equal seat at the table of democracy. And so I do think it is a message for the rest of the country. I just think that we speak with much more moral authority when we acknowledge what it is that we've done and fix our problem first before we try to get across the country. But I think our work will be very resonant in other parts of America, north, south, east, and west.
Now, I know these divisions that you're talking about, you confronted those directly in New Orleans when you were mayor, when you had the Confederate statues removed. And I think a lot of people followed that story as it was happening and probably saw the speech you gave that became kind of a viral thing across the country. But I don't know whether many people know sort of what happened after that. You know, the statues came down. What happened then? So what happened in New Orleans, you know, over the last, as I guess, been maybe 2 years since the statues came down? What's going on there?
Well, interesting. First of all, if you just take the statues down and you don't do anything else, I mean, those are just physical things.
Right.
Those statues represent a mindset of how people think. What's interesting about the process, and, you know, I was seemed to go on forever, but I really wanted to go through it. I mean, I guess I could have just taken those monuments down like the day after I said I was going to do it, and I think I would have been justified legally in doing it, but I wanted to go through a process and I wanted to follow the law. So we had lots of hearings. They were intense hearings. Now, one of the reasons they were so intense, because a lot of people that weren't from New Orleans, they weren't even from the state of Louisiana, came here as though they had some ownership over those monuments. Now, you know, there are about 3,000 of them around the South. And for people who don't know, they were put up well after the Civil War ended. And they were put up by primarily or in consultation with the Daughters of the Confederacy, who wanted to perpetuate what they self-described as the lost cause, and how terrible it was that the cause of the South was lost when the North, or just the United States of America, won the Civil War. And they wanted to create a narrative of, you know, what our real history was, when in fact they were only talking about a very narrow version of only 4 years of our history. And so, you know, it was in New Orleans, which prides itself on having been one of the wealthiest cities in the country very early during our time, and always being a multicultural city, always a Mecca, always a port town. Those monuments didn't really reflect who we were, and we thought that, incidentally, the picture that it created with the city was so narrow so as to make it actually not the truth, or otherwise stated a lie. So when those monuments finally came down, you know, what has happened, interestingly enough, is that they have the spaces have turned into places where people go to take their own pictures there to get a sense of where they fit in this moment. Lee Circle, quite frankly, old Lee Circle, hasn't been replaced. It stayed there just like it was. And so the pedestal standing, there's nothing on top of it. And although I didn't plan that and I didn't intend it, I wasn't able to do anything by the time I left because time ran out. It's actually not a bad thing for that to sit there empty so people can contemplate what it's really supposed to mean. And I'm hopeful that the city at some point in time, you know, will decide to make that space, which is really the most prominent space in the city, an inviting space that's a demand generator that speaks to what New Orleans really is to the rest of the world, which is the soul of America. I mean, our diversity is our strength.
This podcast will not air for a few days. So we're talking in the middle of the week, and I think it will air the middle of the next week. But I feel like I have to ask you about something that was in the news today, and that was President Trump saying that the impeachment proceedings, he compared them to being lynched. And then Lindsey Graham from South Carolina came behind him and said, yes, in every way, that it's like what's happening to him is like a lynching. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts about it. First of all, the President of the United States, it is clear, worked with a foreign government to investigate his political rivals. The Constitution forbids that in two different places. And as a consequence of that, Congress now has the duty to investigate whether or not that activity rises to the level of an impeachable offense, which is a very sobering, painful thing, a process through which the country has only experienced in one form or another three separate times. And that is very, very troubling. There is testimony being taken now from folks that have been in the government that have served Republican and Democrats. The inspector general that basically said the whistleblower report was critical was a Republican that was appointed by President Trump. This is a very serious nonpartisan matter, and the president unfortunately left Congress with no alternative but to do their duty and to investigate whether or not he actually has abused his power to the point of having been removed from office for the extraordinary process of impeachment that was designed by the founding fathers. You know, when they designed this, they knew that there were going to be elections. They opined that from time to time we could have a chief executive officer that got to be a lot like King George that needed to be removed before an election took place. For the president of the United States, who's white and who's a billionaire, to compare anything that he's going through to a lynching rises to such a height of ignorance and insensitivity that it's actually hard to respond to. For the sake of people in the country who have not really thought about this, Brian Stevenson in Montgomery just opened up a lynching memorial that has listed by name the 3,800 and or so American citizens that were lynched in the South, not in 1850, but between 1870 and as far up as to the late decades of the 20th century into the 60s. Over 3,900 African Americans, in many instances for no reason at all other than looking crooked at a white girl, were ripped away from their homes, beaten, raped, sodomized. Their backs were torn apart by whips, and then they were hung in public squares. Now, that's what lynching is. So when a white man who's a billionaire, who's the most powerful man in the world, compares what's happening to him in a political setting, in many instances what he brought upon himself through a legislative process designed by the founding fathers, is just, to me, it's really disgraceful and it's disgusting. And I can imagine that President Trump is not happy that he's in the position that he's in. But to suggest that it's like a lynching means that either he does not know the history of lynching, or when it happened or why it happened, or he's so insensitive to it that he would compare himself to that. And I just think that, you know, he ought to do better. And Lindsey Graham, of all people, being a son of a South, you know, from a Southern state that's got an incredible, rich and wonderful history in some, but a very, very dark history in other matters, especially on the issue of race and slavery, ought to know better as well. That's sacred ground and sacred language. And, you know, elected officials that represent the South ought to at least hold up the rest of the people in the country to speaking about this in a way that gives respect and understanding and clarity.
When we were talking about the back at the beginning about your project, you seem to say that maybe you would go outside the South and do other parts of the country besides this. Is that kind of part of the idea?
Well, first of all, this is a long, you know, this is a deep dive and it's a long haul. This is not something that's going to be done overnight. It may take, I mean, years and years and years. My dad told me that he was a law student when Brown versus Board of Education came down, and he and his friend said, "Oh my God, finally it's over." And then didn't realize that it was a beginning. I mean, race is the hardest thing that we talk about in this country, and my expectation is it will take quite a long time. But we wanted to start in the South first.
I have a couple more questions about this, but I do want to ask one thing that I feel like I'm sort of obligated to ask. I know in 2018, every time somebody asked you if you were going to run for president, before they could get the question out of their mouths, you said no. I have two quick questions about that. One, considering where everything is right now, a little bit jumbled up in the on the Democratic side, do you regret that at all?
And my question to you is, what do you think obligated you to ask me that question? Well, you got somebody there holding a baseball bat to your head.
Why don't you say
you just wanted to ask me that question?
I did want to ask you that question. I also have a news director who would want to make sure I asked you that question.
Let me see if I can answer it forthrightly. Yes, the answer is no. I did not feel, and I still don't feel, like it was the right time or the right set of circumstances. The next question is, well, you know, will you say that you're never going to do it? Well, in politics, you never say never. You know, I have done this now for 30 years. I've been blessed. I loved public service. I really have enjoyed it. But being the mayor of the city of New Orleans, during the time that I was there, we had to rebuild the city from the devastation of Katrina and Rita and Ike and Gustav and the national recession and the BPO spill. You know, it was a lot. And this just was not a great time for me. The question is, do I have a regret? You know, when you're kind of if you're a horse and you run the track, you know, every time other horses run by you, you kind of get a little sniff and you think, man, I want to be out there. But So I have that. I have that every now and then. I don't lie. I see those guys up on the debate stage, and I've been through many of those. You remember, I ran, let's see, I've run 9 times. I've won 7. So I've been through a horrific number of debates with, you know, folks like you yelling questions at me and say, give me one answer to how to change the world. You know, it could be one word. So, you know, you get a little ping, but I think I made the right decision for me and for my family.
I know your training, and this will kind of wrap up here, your training in law is in mediation, negotiation, getting people in a room, getting them to agree on things, find common ground. Let's fantasize for a minute and say you could get half a dozen people in a room, and they're the people who could actually fix racism in this country. Hmm. How would you start that conversation? What was the first thing?
That's so funny that you would do that, because in Hamilton, the musical, they actually have a song that's called In the Room Where It Happened.
Exactly.
So it's a good song, too. It's a great play if anybody hasn't seen it.
That's right. So let's say if you could be in the room where it happens, how would you start that conversation?
Well, I think the first thing I would ask them would be, do they believe that the Founding Fathers had it right when they said all men were created equal? Or that they had it right as an aspiration that out of many we are one. I think that's the first thing I would ask them. And if they were committed to that proposition, then I would ask them to think of themselves as the Founding Fathers and recognize, looking back, you know, from where we are 200 or so years, whether or not that we've actually lived up to it, to acknowledge, for example, where we have fallen short, and to ask themselves to commit themselves to finding common ground that works for everybody. If, in fact, the people of today said they really do all want to get together, they all think everybody should have equal opportunity, and we want to leave our children better. I actually did this when I was mayor of the city of North Carolina. We had to rebuild the city. We didn't build it back the way it was. I mean, that's a great tendency, is if a building gets knocked down, just put it back up the next day, like your school. But what if the school wasn't great, you know, the day before it got knocked down, and you wanted to build a new one? Wouldn't you build it the way you always wanted it to be? That's really would be kind of the idea of the exercise. And I actually think that there's a great opportunity to do that. But here's the deal. You got to want to find common ground. You know, there are lots of people that want to fight. It is not, I feel naive and silly about this, but I thought everybody wanted to find common ground. That is just not true. There are some people who believe that they can win and that they will have power and they will have money, or they will have opportunity when they win and other people lose, a zero-sum game. It's actually a strategy that some people have, and that is an uncomfortable fact. There are some of us that believe that, no, all of us do better when all of us win, and you got to be committed to that, because if you're not committed to that, it's kind of hard to design something that brings people together when some people want to design something that keeps us apart. And I think that is a political battle, political in the democratic sense of the word. Like, you have to win in the marketplace of ideas. That's got to be a community conversation about what our values are. And I suppose that you do that friend to friend, neighbor to neighbor, baseball team to baseball team, volleyball team to volleyball team, church to church, politician to politician, community to community. You got to build it and knit it together all the way down from the ground all the way up if you want it to hold when we find ourselves under stress. And, you know, because that's when it breaks. If it's not strong, if the safety net of communion is not strong, when the stress comes and the hard times come, it's easy to rip that stuff apart. And you don't want to be there. You want to be resilient and strong so you can take whatever comes your way, because the values are the things that at the end of the day will outweigh the anger and the frustration and the anxiety. And unfortunately, the safety net from that perspective, the safety net of democracy is really frayed right now. And I think we have to be purposeful, intentional about putting it back together.
Mitch Landry's effort is one of dozens, maybe hundreds, that have attempted to chip away at the problems that have haunted our region for centuries. It can be easy to dismiss all this as hopeless, especially in these days we're living in. But there are two ways change happens in the world. One is through revolutionary moments, marches or speeches or events that push history forward all at once. And the other way is through the small, slow grind of daily life. Running into people at the grocery store. Talking to your neighbor. Stepping outside your comfortable place to understand another human being. Nobody really notices that change when it's happening. You just wake up one day and it's happened. It's not nearly as fast or as final as most of us would like. But every conversation is like a wave against the rocks. One wave doesn't do much, but enough waves turn the hardest rocks into sand. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.